Welcome to episode 279 of the Energy Talks podcast. I'm energy and climate journalist Markham Hislop. Today, March 1st, the Government of Canada announced $50 million of federal funding for preliminary work on a potentially huge Bruce Power nuclear project in southern Ontario. This is in addition to the 2023 plan by the Ontario government to procure 2,000 megawatts of new electricity generation capacity from renewables, including wind, solar, and hydro by 2030, with the potential for another 3,000 megawatts by 2034. Despite the Ford government's change of face, Professor Mark Winfield of York University says that Ontario remains on the, and I quote, same high carbon, high risk, and high cost pathway of nuclear and natural gas fired generation expansion that it was on before. I've interviewed Mark about the Ontario electricity system a few times, but in light of recent developments, it seems like a good time for another conversation. So welcome to the interview, Mark.
Hi, Markham.
So we know that the Canadian government is eager to promote nuclear power. I mean, it's entered into agreements with other provinces, and it's supported the idea publicly. It's got its budgeted funds in various budgets to support this kind of work. What are they doing in Ontario?
Well, there's two things. There is this recent announcement, which is around the notion of adding, apparently, somewhere around 4,800 megawatts of new capacity at Bruce. This would be on top of the refurbishment of six reactors there at a cost of about $25 billion. And then they're also putting, they are, through the Infrastructure Bank at the moment, the only investor in a proposal for a smaller reactor, 300 megawatts at Darlington, of which there are supposed to be now three more. So we've moved from certainly encouragement now into the federal government actually financing the Ontario government's nuclear ambitions.
So my understanding is that the refurbishment at Bruce is going to cost somewhere around $50 billion?
The refurbishment will be somewhere in the $20 to $25 billion range. That's for the six existing units.
And then the
back of envelope estimate based on the previous proposals for new builds in Ontario for 4,800 megawatts new capacity at Bruce came out at in the $50 billion range.
So to refurbish one and build the other is $75 billion altogether.
That's the ballpark we're talking about for Bruce alone.
Now, I'm curious about where this money comes to build these, because, and I'll use Alberta as an example. So a couple of years ago, the Alberta Electricity System Operator did a study. And they said, okay, we're going to get Alberta to net zero. And there are a couple or three pathways. Some of them had gas and carbon capture. One of them had a lot of renewables. Couldn't go 100% renewables, but a lot of renewables. And the point that the Miranda Keating Erickson, who was the vice president I interviewed, she said, look, it's going to cost us $42 billion to $55 billion in that range. 90% of it will come from the private sector. And because they're going to be building wind and solar farms, or they're going to be building a gas-fired power plant. It's not going to be public money. The public money will presumably go into things like, you know, modernizing the grid and bringing in storage, that kind of thing. So when I see a price tag of $75 billion, I ask, how much is the taxpayer going to be expected to pick up?
That's a very good question. And keep in mind, too, that the total for Ontario is over $100 billion on nuclear. Because you have to consider the existing refurbishment at Darlington, which is supposed to cost $12 to $13 billion for four units. And now Pickering B, which is another four units, which again, optimistically, would be in the $10 to $15 billion range, because it's even older than Darlington. So we're well past $100 billion. That's a very good question, is who's going to finance this? Because the past record with nuclear has not been very good. Private capital doesn't like it. Because of the record of delays and cost overruns that we've seen in both with the original nuclear construction in the 70s and 80s, and then with the sort of renaissance in the late 2000s in Europe and the US, but that's actually only four projects. Private capital looks at it and says, there's a whole lot better places we can put capital, even in an energy transition context. There's a lot better places we can put capital. To say the it's very striking. So far, the only actual investor in the new build at Darlington is the Canada Infrastructure Bank, which is the government of Canada.
Well, it's interesting that in the recent memory, the only nuclear projects that appear to have come in, I don't know about on schedule, but on budget, sort of, are in China. And I think there were a couple in Russia that did. And I'm not sure that a market economy in a democracy like Canada should look to Russia and China as guidelines for whether or not these particular projects will be on schedule and on budget. Because if we look at other big projects, the Trans Mountain Expansion Pipeline, for example, went from, you know, around $10 billion, $12 billion, and I think it's going to end up around $35 billion. That was built essentially by the federal government. But the Coastal Gas Link Pipeline started out around $8 or $10 billion and wound up at $30 billion, and that was entirely privately financed. So it seems like every time there's a big project of this kind, cost overruns are just baked into the cake.
And indeed, the track record with nuclear projects is around 2.5 times the original cost estimates, both in Canada and in other jurisdictions where there is some notion of transparency and honesty in the accounting, which would be, you know, UK, France, the United States, Finland, you know, that has been the record. And part of the problem would make things even worse in this case is that any new builds especially are going to involve basically prototypical technologies that they don't exist anywhere else at this stage, so far as we understand, with what's being thought about. You know, certainly the SMR, the supposed SMRs are not that small, the 300 megawatts at Darlington, don't exist. These would be the prototypes. So the risks are even bigger. You know, you're not using a known technology. These would be technologies that are unknown to the regulator. So the risk just piles on. So I would think if you're private capital, you're going to be looking for different places to make your investment. And we kind of saw this during the Obama period in the United States with the sort of Recovery and Reconstruction Act, sort of post-2008. The Obama administration shoveled billions in tax expenditures and subsidies and everything else at the nuclear industry in the United States. And in the end, they got one project with two reactors, the Vogtle project in Georgia. So that tells you that even if you pile on the subsidies, private capital doesn't seem interested. In the energy space, there's better places to put your money.
Yeah, you know, particularly in the American context, the Americans are quite happy to de-risk early stage technologies. That they, you know, to have the government pay for that de-risking until private capital concludes that the risk is low enough that it will then come in and provide financing. So here this is not new tech. Well, I guess the SMRs are considered new technology.
These would be new reactor designs. These are not CANDUs.
Right.
So these are things that only exist as some people put it, as PowerPoints, as opposed to anyone having actually built them and got them to operate and found out how much it really might cost to build one.
So Is there an argument to be made? And I'll just play devil's advocate here for a moment. Given the American track record of funding the de-risking of new technologies and the benefits that have flown to the U.S. economy, and they're building over decades of an innovation economy that really has stood them in good stead, despite the fact that China is now kicking their butt in clean energy technology. But that's grist for another conversation. The fact that where I'm getting going with this is there an argument for the federal government, in partnership with the Ontario government, to step in here, pay the money, de-risk SMR technology on the chance that it will actually be successful and then something that Canada can pick up and run with?
It's a terribly expensive and risky de-risking. And in effect, that's what the governments of Canada and Ontario did in the 1950s and the 1960s with CANDU. And the notion was the world was going to beat a path to our door and buy CANDUs. In the end, the only people who bought them were Ceausescu and military juntas in South Korea and Argentina. And there were massive bribery scandals, if you may recall, from the 1970s involving AECL about that. There were some sales to China too. We kind of tried this before, and at least in that case, the technology that was being underwritten at least was Canadian and was at least going to be, you know, designed, built, supply chained in Canada. At the moment, there are no viable Canadian designs. What's being talked about for Darlington is a U.S. design and Japanese design. We're not de-risking a domestic industry. I mean, we tried that once in this sector. So again, I'm left with as a head scratcher on this one. It's not like the reactors which would likely be built in these places are going to be Canadian designed and Canadian built. This is just part of what makes this bizarre in terms of where we're going with this.
My understanding is I interviewed one of the vice presidents at OPG, Ontario Power and Gas, which is building an SMR and hopes to have it done, fingers crossed, in 2028, but maybe 2032. We'll see how that turns out.
Yeah, we'll see.
But if I remember correctly, it was Hitachi Energy that was building it. So this is Japanese technology. And essentially, does that mean that if the federal, I mean, it looks like there's going to be government money involved here. There just is. And we basically, we get a power plant, assuming that it ever works, but nothing else, no supply chains, no expertise.
Seems to be what we're doing here, is we're buying an offshore technology, which doesn't actually exist. There isn't even a prototype of the reactor design that they're talking about. It's a type that has never been seen by the Canadian regulator, the CNSC. I think that seems to be what we're looking at, is that we're buying an offshore technology that doesn't do. I mean, as I say, historically, there was an economic rationale behind the Canada-Ontario strategy in the 1960s and 70s and 50s around CANDU, because the whole idea was you were building a Canadian design, Canadian built reactor, Canadian supply chain, for which there would then, because we demonstrate it works so well at Pickering and Darlington and Bruce, that the world would beat a path to our door. It doesn't work that way, but you know, that at least there was a kind of an economic rationale there for that investment as an industrial strategy. But here, that doesn't seem to be the case at all, that we're buying a completely offshore technology. We're helping somebody else sell reactors. So, this seems to be part of what is so puzzling about all of this, is that the rationale that was there in the first go round, now 70 years ago, even that's not there anymore.
There's a higher level issue here, and no, you and I have talked about in the past the lack of energy planning in Ontario. I mean, they're just stuff gets pulled off the shelf and put into a press release and becomes a project, but there's no plan, no strategy, there's no public input, there's nothing you can point to and say, oh, well, this is what the government's doing on energy. This is how it's going to, you know, for instance, how we're going to pivot from fossil fuels to clean energy, to clean electricity. And we're going to double or triple our power grid over, you know, 20, 30 years. And the kind of things that other jurisdictions are grappling with. There's none of that in Ontario. Okay, so fair enough. But the question then becomes, what's the federal government doing? Because the federal government has actually talked about industrial strategy and industrial policy. And by that, they mean, you know, building these hubs of around new technology like hydrogen in the Edmonton area, where you attract anchor companies that are going to build hydrogen plants in the case of Edmonton, but then also the supply chains and also the expertise. And it's not unlike what you know, they did it in with CANDU in Ontario back in the, you know, 50s, 60s, and 70s. We used to understand industrial policy, but now industrial policy. I asked Natural Resources Minister Jonathan Wilkinson this at a press conference. He says, what is Canada's industrial policy? He said it has three components. It's got its carbon tax, regulations, and subsidies. I said, boy, that sure doesn't sound like the Inflation Reduction Act to me. It doesn't sound like what China did. It doesn't sound like what the European New Green Deal. It doesn't sound like any of those. It just sounds like a bunch of programs. And that's essentially what we've done what the federal government has done. It has pots of money that it hopes proponents will come forward and put in applications, and then they will shovel taxpayer dollars out the back door to those projects and keep their fingers crossed that some of them actually stick to the wall. And so we've got lack of planning in Ontario. We've got the lack of any kind of coherent industrial strategy and policy in Ottawa, but we do have lots of big pots of money, like the Infrastructure Bank and the Green Fund and so on. That just sounds like a recipe for disaster.
It's a recipe for an awful lot of public money going out the door and an awful lot of debt being built up and a lot of fiscal capacity being burned up in the process without much certainty about outcomes. And in some cases, I mean, I've heard elsewhere that there needs to be a much better screening of what actually the money is going into, both from an economic perspective, but also from a sustainability perspective. I mean, some of that is sorting itself out, particularly the hydrogen stuff. It's just turning out to be uneconomic, except in certain specific applications. The problem with nuclear, especially this dimension of this, is that it's unique in the sense that it carries with it these enormous legacy costs. It's not just a question of, well, it didn't work. It's like the sprung greenhouse in Newfoundland. Well, it didn't work, and we got an empty building now. This is something which carries with it enormous legacy costs that stretch over millennia. So this one is one around which the bar probably should be a whole lot higher. Because the risk of success, or even in some cases success, say nothing of failure, are quite different, or qualitatively different from other technologies where you just are kind of walking away, well, it didn't work. And yeah, that was a risk we took because we were taking risks. This one carries with it unusually significant legacy costs and risks that we need to be very sensitive to.
Within the last couple of months, I've done quite a number of interviews with experts around power grids. Gerhard Schlage, of Hitachi Energy, would be one. And did one yesterday with an engineer, this morning, who Burns and McDonald, the engineers out of the U.S., and they're installing battery, utility-scale battery projects on grids around the U.S. And Then we've looked at China and how it's built up, it's scaled up its solar panel module manufacturing to the point where now, you know, like 12 cents a watt compared to 40 cents a watt for the US. I mean, you just can't get energy that cheap. My point here is that it's become obvious, I think, that we're looking at a variable energy generation coupled with a re-engineered, modernized grid and some of these other technologies like microgrids and virtual power plants and so on. And that seems to me to be the future of electricity systems. That'll be the bulk of it. Yes, there'll always be some hydro and some nuclear and some geothermal, and but really the heart of the thing is going to be variable energy with a rebuilt grid that can accommodate them. So Canada missed the memo.
We seem to miss. Yeah.
No. Nobody is doing this. I mean, I get it in hydro provinces, you know, like Quebec and Manitoba and British Columbia. I mean, you've got something nobody else has got. Why wouldn't you double down on that? But in places like Alberta and Ontario, I just don't see it. And it seems to be that they're looking for technologies that they can just, that are drop-in replacements for what they have, so that you can continue with this vertically integrated hub and spoke kind of system without having to do the hard work that the Americans are doing, the Chinese are doing, the Europeans are doing, and redoing your grid to make it more efficient and lower cost. They just want to do whatever, you know, the easiest thing. That's kind of what it's looking like at this point.
I would not disagree at all. I think that's very much what's going on. I mean, you can look at what's happening in Ontario around nuclear and gas as a triumph of an incumbent, Ontario Power Generation, because they own all these assets. And although there have been very interesting discussions about distributed resources, and we've talked about this too, you know, and Ontario in some ways is particularly well positioned because we have a network of local distribution utilities who want to be DER aggregators and distribution level market operators. We have an unusually well set up institutional and in fact, to some degree, grid configuration. We have actors who are engaged at the distribution level who want to do this. And they are stuck in what is termed the regulatory sandbox. That sure, you can play around with this, but there's no way we're letting this become a significant asset in the system. And yet in Alberta, Ontario, Saskatchewan, Maritimes, this may well make a whole lot of sense. It's where these sort of converging technological revolutions come to storage, you know, renewables, grid integration, and, you know, what used to be called smart grids. I think we need a better term for that now. This is where this comes into play. And it also, you know, particularly then if you're going to have fleets of parked electric vehicles, which are basically fleets of high capacity storage assets in the systems as well. I mean, these are this point that the modelers make to me about this, you know, that it's also the loads are becoming more dynamic, you know, and EVs are the classic example of that they're going to, you know, they can be both storage and they can be load, and but they also are highly variable, as you say, but flexible in other ways. That would seem to be the pathway to follow, which also avoids a lot of these very high risk, you know, big capital, big centralized assets, of which, again, Ontario's nuclear program is like the poster child of poster childs at the moment. But Canadian utilities don't seem interested because it is a threat to the underlying business model of what are basically vertically integrated utilities.
Let's talk about incumbents for a minute, because you brought this up in other interviews that I've done with you. And I wrote a column that just published today in which I argued that Wednesday's announcement from the Alberta government that it would, I mean, it ended the 7-month moratorium on wind and solar development. And essentially that was the hard moratorium that it was done under the authority of the regulator, ordered by the government. And now they have so many bizarre rules that it is in fact a soft moratorium. You're not saying you can't do it, but you've made it so difficult that nobody's going to do it.
It's impossible.
So, and I argued in the column that the problem, this is illustrates a bigger problem of the Danielle Smith and her UCP government is they are the champions of incumbents. They will protect the big utilities in Alberta. They will protect the big oil and gas companies in Alberta. They will protect the big petrochemical industries. And it seems like the Ford government is exactly like that. And the Moe government in Saskatchewan will protect SAS Power and its coal assets and its gas assets. They don't want change to come in and disrupt what is, from their point of view, a workable system. Never mind that change is coming anyway and they can't stop it. That is the fundamental problem. So if you look at BC and Quebec, which are the two provinces that are leading the energy transition and the expansion of electricity, they're hydro provinces and their governments made them. Their governments sent policy directions to the Crown Corporation and said, you will do this, you will generate enough clean electricity and you will upgrade your transmission and distribution enough that we can adopt electric vehicles, we can put in heat pumps, we can do electric industrial processes and on and on. And then the Crowns went away and now they have plans and they're beginning to look at it. In the other places where the government refused to do that and protects the incumbents, now we have a mess like we have in Ontario.
No, this is a defense of the incumbents and a triumph of the incumbents in many ways in both Alberta and Ontario. You've got governments that are extremely receptive to the incumbent actors. And in Ontario, there's other examples of that as well in other unrelated sectors. It's part of the governance model that you're dealing with here. And they're not interested in pathways that would challenge. I mean, they don't listen to the voice. They listen to the incumbents fundamentally is the governance model here, is that they listen to the already dominant actors and reinforce their position. With the Ford government, we see this across a whole bunch of, across healthcare, across land use planning and development. Is all, it's a very, very consistent pattern in terms of how they approach things. The problem is that it's not one that is necessarily very conducive to change or to innovation. Quite the opposite. In some ways, it's a policy model designed to protect incumbents. Even though at times I'm not sure with the Ford government anyway, I'm not entirely sure they realize that. With Ms. Smith, I'm not sure either, but that's certainly the consequence.
I can confirm that she hasn't got a clue, but grist for another conversation.
Yeah. No, I think in both cases, these are governments which are sort of almost instinctively receptive to these kinds of voices who they perceive as authoritative and powerful. But that does create this in a changing world that becomes very, very problematic in the sense of their unwillingness to embrace the possibility of change or different pathways.
Now, I'm sitting on the west coast of Canada on Vancouver Island, and I'm watching what the NDP government here does with its Crown Corporation, BC Hydro, which is finally they're getting it to move. But we do most of our work in Alberta and somewhat in Saskatchewan. So I'm very familiar with those. We're doing a little work in Ontario, and so I know roughly what you're going through. But you're based in Ontario in Toronto at York University. And my hypothesis here, Mark, for why we have the scenario that you and I have just discussed for the last 5 minutes or so of the power of incumbents to impede change and innovation. And a lot of it comes from the fact that Canada is such a very insular country. Like I say this all the time. Out of the 400 or 500 interviews that I do every year, half of them are with international experts, and it's very deliberate. I want to know what Americans think. I want to know what Europeans think. I want to know what Asians think. And once you get outside of Canada and you look at what other policy changes are there, what regulators are doing, what private capital is doing, it's a different world. It is just, Canada is just this sleepy little backwater that is at least a decade behind and maybe more. And we're having debates and conversations about issues that, frankly, the rest of the world has moved on. You know, any of the countries that are trying to lead the energy transition or play that are players in the energy transition, they've resolved these issues at the national level and subnational level long, long time ago. And they're embarking on strategies and attracting investment and building industry and doing all the things that need to be done. And you come to Canada and it's like, holy moly, but our elites don't look outside our boundaries and aren't plugged in to the extent that others are. And we just don't have the leadership. We do in the business level, at the political level, on all sorts of. Anyway, this is a favorite rant of mine, and I'm going to stop now and get you to respond. But that's kind of my take on it.
There is a strong element of that, which I think you're right, has in some ways become more prevalent. It may be partially a function of the living next to the giant, which also is tending to look more and more inwards. But we've also have a history of relative energy security and abundance, which is also a factor in Canada's case, that this has not been a problem historically and has been seen potentially as a source of economic advantage, both in terms of our ability to provide energy cheaply, but also to extract and export energy resources. And that's a very, very deeply rooted economic paradigm in Canadian history. One, you know, Harold Innes and others would understand very, very well.
The Staples thesis.
Yes, exactly. These are just staples along the chain. And the problem is exactly as Innes and others have pointed out, and Mel Watkins later on and others, and Brendan Hawley these days, you know, that this tends to produce a relatively non-innovative economy to begin with. But then we are, I think, becoming, particularly with governments like the Smith government in Alberta, Mr. Ford, you know, even more inwardly looking and less outward looking in terms of innovation. And so that just reinforces the double down on the incumbents and the existing pathways, and that adds to the challenges, and makes, you know, innovation or changing pathways becomes very, very difficult in that kind of context. We're in a kind of some ways a institutional and innovative retreat at this stage, that the incumbents are becoming more powerful than ever, and the new entrants are being pushed out.
I'll illustrate the argument I'm going to make by pointing to my interview with Gerhard Schlage, who is a veteran power sector player and now runs Hitachi's global, I forget what department he's in, doesn't matter, power sector expert. And his point was that the changes that are coming, there are so many new power sector technologies. We've got artificial intelligence. We've got grid-enhancing technology, so you can put more power down a line. We've got distributed energy resources, virtual power plants, batteries. And literally power grids around the world are being transformed in real time by these technologies, and plenty more are coming. Plenty more are coming, like you mentioned. EVs as a storage capacity, so vehicle to grid integration is going to be a big thing in the not too distant future. And the problem becomes, I think, that we are outside of all of that innovation. And I have this conversation in Alberta all the time. You know, they go, we're literally at the point where people, politicians and industry leaders, will get up and say, well, you know, the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow all the time, and none of this will work. And if you talk to Gerhard Schlage, he'd say, well, okay, that's because you haven't re-engineered your grid to accommodate variable resources. And if you did this long laundry list of things, if you invested in your grid and you did what you were supposed to do, it would all work just fine. And it would be low cost and reliable and flexible and all of these other things that you need it to be in the 21st century. And the conversation around this is startlingly backward in Canada. It's just astounding how stunted our thinking is in this area. And I guess, okay, we've talked about why that is, but what do we do going forward to change that?
Well, this is the challenge. I mean, that all of the things that you just talked about around grid innovation, I mean, we have these, I talk about as converging mutually supportive technological revolutions around renewables, grid management, storage, going on, but Canada in effect seems to kind of choose to insulate itself from that because it threatens the incumbents. And we restrict it to, you know, what are literally referred to as regulatory sandboxes, at least in Ontario. And Ontario seems to be I'm part of another project which is actually looking at this. And strange enough, Ontario seems furthest down the pipe than any other jurisdiction in Canada at the moment, at least that the Ontario Energy Board hosts a space in which there are official conversations about these kinds of things and where they might be going. But they are emphatically restricted to the sandbox, not commercial scale deployment. And that, I think, is where we're going to have to move is around facilitating integration of these kinds of technologies. Some of it may happen on its own. It sort of has a momentum of its own as the things evolve. But we're going to have to think about how we approach regulation, market entry in these sectors. Particularly, we do anticipate electricity demand is going to go up. Whether that needs to go up through centralized assets like the kind that Ontario apparently is going to spend $100 billion on is a completely different question. And it may be that we can facilitate that to some degree. It may be it happens on its own, particularly as the costs of trying to cover those kinds of centralized investments start to be reflected in grid costs. You know, you may start to see people defecting on their own anyway. The problem is that
if I can interrupt, and I apologize for this. I try very hard not to interrupt my guests, but I have an anecdote here that is directly related to what you're saying. The Alberta Electricity System Operator, AESO, undertook a study and they went out to their stakeholders and they published a study in 2022. And what I remember most about reading that report was the palpable fear that emanated from those pages that big industrial operators and commercial operators were going to self-generate and disconnect from the grid, and the rest of the folks on the grid were going to have to pay much higher transmission fees and distribution fees. And that seems to be about where we're at. It is, instead of planning to fix it and accommodate, you know, all of those kind of things. And so that, I think that just illustrates your point.
Yeah, no, you will have people simply self-generate behind the meter because the costs around grid of trying to do this through big centralized infrastructure is just going to become prohibitive. And there's a limit to the extent of which, I mean, Ontario is already subsidizes electricity rates to the tune of $7 billion a year out of general revenues. There's a limit to how much you can do that. And obviously a cost in terms of the things that $7 billion could have gone on otherwise. So that is the concern, is that there's concerns about grid defection. There are concerns about erosion of bulk grid demand and the stranding of assets. But the answer to that, I don't think, is to build more massive strandable assets, which is effectively what Ontario is proposing to do. The appropriate answer is well, you're going to have to make it so that it makes sense to remain connected to the grid from a reliability, but also from an integration and sharing kind of perspective in a more network kind of sense. Because yes, those who can defect and self-generate, and the technologies are enabling more and more of that, are going to do that. I think that's a very significant risk, because either they move, which in some cases they can't do because they're tied to the resource, or they self-generate and insulate themselves from the grid costs. And there's, particularly on the scale of the kind of cost being talked about in Ontario, which ultimately is, the number's been talked around, is $400 billion. There's a limit to how much governments can subsidize those kinds of costs and try and hide them, which is what the government's doing at the moment.
Here are some costs that have popped up recently on my radar. So I mentioned before the Chinese solar panel manufacturers are selling for 12 cents a watt. But over the next 3 years, the amount of solar installed is predicted to double. And that would, you would then see a reduction, thanks to Wright's law, you would see a reduction in the cost per unit. And then in 18 months after that, so now we're talking like 5 years, basically, then you see another reduction, doubling and reduction. So the odds are pretty good that we're going to see a sub 10 cents a watt module in the not too distant future. So the point here is that generating clean electricity is getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And you can, you know, any factory, any paper plant, pulp and paper plant can stick solar panels on their property and on their buildings, and there's nothing the government can do about it. Then on top of that, storage used to be not that long ago, it was $100 a kilowatt hour, megawatt hour. And now is we're talking about in 2024, $56. And then we're going to see it drop further. And then we're going to see some new chemistries like sodium ion and zinc ion and solid state and so on that improve energy density. My point that I'm getting to is that the self-generation by the companies that are big enough and can afford it is getting easier and easier and easier by the month, not by the year, by the month. And it only seems to me inevitable that eventually the costs will drop low enough and it'll be easy enough that we will see significant grid defection if we keep going down the road that we're going on, as we just discussed.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's going to happen in different ways. And keeping in mind, storage is not just batteries, especially if you're stationary. It can be all kinds of different things. But yeah, you know, the opportunities are there. That there is a technological revolution, or as I say, multiple mutually reinforcing technological revolutions going on here, which are going to facilitate those kinds of pathways, and particularly if grid electricity becomes more and more expensive because we're trying to make $100 billion investments in centralized technologies, and that's the optimistic financial estimate. It just reinforces that pathway. But you know, the downside being these risks of very large asset stranding as the world moves on, and those who can get off the grid get off the grid. I mean, this was all stuff we talked about in the 1970s, but now seems to be technologically much more feasible than when Amory Lovins talked about this 50 years ago. That was a pipe dream. Now, this is very, very doable. You know, we have the technology on the renewable side, the storage side, and the grid management integration sides, or system integration system sides, to be able to do that. And people will realize this. And that is the direction they may well go.
Once again, science fiction leads the way and reality catches up eventually. Well, look, Mark, this has been fascinating, and as always, and we'll look forward to more conversations in the future. I'm officially depressed now. I'm going to have to go and do something to cheer myself up, because on the one hand, you know, I think we'll muddle through, which is the Canadian way, but it's going to cost us a lot of money, and we're going to make a lot of mistakes along the way that we don't have to, that are foreseeable, and that we, you know, we have other options. So thank you very much for this. Always appreciate it.
Great. Well, thank you, Mark. I'm very, very nice talking to you.